Why did the shooting war between Iran and Israel really end? That's a really important question. Also, the Fordow nuclear facility, was it really destroyed by the United States? And by the way, is the shooting war between Iran and Israel, is it really over? Well, the President of the United States says so. Moments ago, literally seconds ago, I'm being told by our producers that President Trump came out as he was meeting with NATO officials and said, yes, the war is over, I guarantee it, and we did destroy everything that's going on inside of Iran. He also said the sanctions on Iran are going to stay. These are the words of Donald Trump. We're going to try and turn those around for you and share them with you. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is The Sanchez Effect. Boy, lots to talk about. Let's do this. All right, I want to start with something that happened earlier today. This is interesting because it kind of sets the stage for what we're going to be talking about. This comes from the Iranian parliament. The speaker of the Iranian parliament, who, by the way, and this is important, for the longest time, Iran has been cooperating, right, with the Atomic Energy Agency, the folks who go in there to make sure that Iran actually does not have nuclear energy that they're actually converting into nuclear weapons. And so far, all the reports were that they were not using it for nuclear weapons. They were using it to make electricity, right? Well, the Iranian parliament has just voted to no longer cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency. In fact, here it is. I'll let you hear it for yourself.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, which didn't even pretend to condemn the attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, has squandered its international credibility. Therefore, until the security of Iran's nuclear facilities can be guaranteed, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran is suspending its cooperation with the IAEA, and Iran's peaceful nuclear program will proceed more rapidly.
And there you see the Death to America chant from members of parliament, which no doubt is going to be the only thing that you're going to see on Fox and CNN for the rest of the day, despite the fact that there is some important information. For example, that when you consider the fact that Iran is now saying they're not going to cooperate, a lot of people around the world are asking, well, then did this war, did these attacks do the opposite of what it was intended to? Because that means to me that Iran could very possibly now be unchecked and they might decide that they're going to make a bomb because they need it to protect themselves from the people who bombed them. It gets very, very curious. By the way, here's something else that gets extremely curious. We're now getting an intel report from the CIA, apparently it was leaked, that seems to be saying that the Fordow facility, which the president and the White House announced was destroyed thoroughly, was not destroyed thoroughly. So this attack on Fordow, according to the report, CNN is the one that broke the story, by the way, they're saying they did not destroy the nuclear site, only that they damaged it. So I think it's time to try and get some information from somebody who might be inside Iran, somebody in Tehran. And for that, we are joined by Mohammad Marandi, the professor at Tehran University, who usually has the scoop on what's going on inside Iran. There is so much that we need to talk about, Mo, especially when it comes to the question about... Maybe I'm going to start with this, because I think it's the best question to ask. Is the war over, or are you still at war with Israel right now?
Well, Rick, you know that we did not initiate this aggression. It was the Israeli regime that carried out an illegal act of war, which was unprovoked. They slaughtered many innocent people. Mm-hmm. The people who they targeted them alongside their families, alongside their children, their grandchildren, their neighbors. In one case, the Israeli regime brought down an entire apartment building, killing between 65 to 70 people, including over 20 kids, just to murder one or two senior officers. Mm. And but Western media was portraying that initial blitzkrieg as some sort of intelligence coup, whereas people's homes are no secret in Iran. But it really depends on the United States and the Israeli regime. As you saw, when the it's not really a ceasefire, it's a halt of hostilities. Mm. But when it stopped, Iran was hammering the Israeli regime very heavily. And I think many have seen Trump just hours ago admit that during the last couple of days, in particular, the regime in Tel Aviv was hit very hard. Mm. So it depends on the U.S. and the Israeli regime. Iran did not start it, but if they start something again, Iran will make sure next time it's much more painful for Tel Aviv.
So I get from your answer, just to be clear, that you are under the understanding that right now Iran is not hitting Israel and has no plans to hit Israel preemptively. They will only hit Israel if Israel continues to hit Iran. Did I get that right?
Of course, because over the past 250 years, almost 300 years, Iran has never initiated any war. Mm. And after the revolution, we had Saddam Hussein invade the country at the behest of the United States and the Soviet Union back then. So this was Israeli aggression. It was murderous. But the Iranians quickly regrouped and started hammering the regime. And it was ultimately Netanyahu who was begging for a ceasefire.
Is that why it stopped? But you just said something interesting, and I don't mean to interrupt you because you and I have had so many conversations over the years. So I know where you're going here, and I want to get you there. Are you saying that the reason this war really stopped was because you were, in fact, defeating or doing too much damage to Israel and they kind of cried uncle?
Absolutely. That's exactly what happened. And Trump intervened basically on Netanyahu's behalf. And the last strikes before the ceasefire were carried out by the Iranians. The last 2 hours, we saw six waves of Iranian missile strikes. And Trump himself said, especially the last 2 days, not just the last couple of hours, but the last 2 days were particularly painful for Netanyahu and his people. And especially since in the last few days, Iran increasingly was using more high-tech missiles that were very precise. And so they were striking key targets. The first few days, they were using older missiles, which hit, as you can see on the screen, that's from the earlier days, but the later days were much more painful for the regime.
So Donald Trump said the war is over, the fighting will stop. He also just said, according to my producers who are telling me, that the sanctions against Iran will continue. And by the way, he also said that they did destroy Ferdo, despite what the intel reports suggest. Why don't we start there? What can you tell us about Ferdo? Because I heard and read that there was nuclear materials that were removed from the facility prior to the strike, and that the United States knew about that. Is that true?
Not just in Ferdo, but also in the two other sites that the U.S. struck. Uh-huh. Including Isfahan, the key assets were removed. And also, the Iranians have a very impressive industrial capability that is spread out across the country. And all of these nuclear needs are met by Iranian companies. So rebuilding what's been damaged or destroyed is easy, but the key assets were removed, and I find it, I think that the sources that gave CNN that information are probably very credible, because Ferdo is deep under a mountain. And we know that Trump speaks, and mm-hmm. and nothing that he says really can be taken seriously. In fact, now that he says he guarantees that the war is over, it makes me go back to the night before the Israeli assault, when Trump said he's against an attack. And then as soon as it happened, he was gloating about the attack and telling us how it was really him behind it. So no one in Iran is going to trust anything that he says.
In fact, we have the president now. He spoke just moments ago. We've been able to turn around the tape. Professor, let's listen to it together, you and I. Here it is.
As you know, last weekend, the United States successfully carried out a massive precision strike on Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities, and it was very, very successful. It was called obliteration. We've also spoken to people who have seen the site, and the site is obliterated. And we think everything nuclear is down there. They didn't take it out. No other military on Earth could have done it. And now this incredible exercise of American strength has paved the way for peace with a historic ceasefire agreement late Monday. And we call it the 12-day war. Spoke to a few people. I guess that just sounded like the right name. It was a 12-day war. And we think it's over. I don't think they're going to be going back at each other. I don't think so.
So to hear the president tell it, and there's more that he said, your country is now destroyed. You're going to continue to be sanctioned. Your nuclear facilities and a lot else is completely, his word, obliterated. Is that really the case? And to hear him say it, let me also characterize it this way. You are 100% the loser in this. How would you refute that?
I think that I don't really have to explain how honest Trump is, because I think he's a well-known person and his dishonesty is widely known. But the fact is that if the Israeli regime was successful, the war, their invasion, their a war of aggression, because it wasn't two countries going at each other. It was a regime that went after Iran. Iran was minding its own business. So if the regime, if Netanyahu was successful, it wouldn't have ended. He would have just continued to strike again and again and again. And the fact is that he needed this war to end. And Iran, after teaching the regime a lesson, it halted the hostilities because it wanted to show the international community, meaning the global South, because Iran does not really care about what Western governments think, but it wanted the global South to see that in the face of this aggression, Iran successfully defended itself, but it ended the conflict as soon as possible in order to prevent some sort of global economic catastrophe, because the Persian Gulf is a very sensitive place. But I think U.S. intelligence, just like Tulsi Gabbard before admitted that Iran was not producing nuclear weapons just a few months ago, and Trump said, I don't care what she says. And then she had to flip in order to seek the approval of Trump.
Yeah.
Right now, U.S. intelligence is basically saying what Trump has said is not true. So I think when U.S. intelligence is leaking that sort of information, I don't really have to go any further. I doubt highly that, personally, that that Trump did succeed. And I think, actually, he made a catastrophic mistake. And you alluded to that, because now Iran has a very good excuse not to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency. In the past, all of these places that were bombed illegally by the United States in an act of war and an act of aggression, they were regularly visited by IAEA inspectors. Well, now that's going to stop, and it's going to stop everywhere in Iran. And so that gives Iran much more room for maneuver.
And that means if Iran does decide it's going to create weaponry from nuclear material, we won't know about it. Nobody will know about it.
Well, that is, of course, a hypothetical.
It
and,
is.
Iran has shown great restraint over the decades. You know, Rick, when I was young, I fought in the war as a volunteer when Saddam Hussein, at the behest of the West, invaded the country. The West gave him chemical weapons to use against Iranians. They gave him the political cover and the military intelligence to use it, especially Germany gave the weapons itself, but the rest gave political cover and military intelligence. I survived two chemical attacks, both mustard and a nerve agent. At that time, during the war, officials went to the leader at that time, Ayatollah Khomeini, and said, we want to develop chemical weapons. And he said, no. He said, it's an inhumane weapon. And by the way, at that time, the West was also blocking Iran from purchasing gas masks. So Iran has a history of opposing weapons of mass destruction. And that is why I believe that Iran has always had the moral high ground in its conflicts with the West. But of course, Western media, Western regimes, they portray themselves as the ones who are good and everyone else is evil. But, you know, we should tell that, they should tell that to all those Iranians who are still dying a slow death of chemical weapons.
In fact, I can add something to that. I reported on that story when it happened. At the time, I was working at CNN, and I can tell you that it was through the CIA and the Defense Department, working through the Chilean government, that they were able to get those chemical weapons into the hands of Saddam Hussein and Iraq so that he can use it against your country. And that has been found already in the archives, and it has been proven. So it's what you said is not something that you heard in Iran. This is something that has all been, that has already been reported. And if you do your work, you can find it in some of the periodicals like the New York Times. I want to share some things with you. By the way, here's something else I want to ask you that I think is really important for our viewers to understand. The United States and the Netanyahu government said on many occasions what they were trying to do was create regime change in your government. To create regime change, it has to be bottom up. That means they needed to get the people in Iran to hate both the Ayatollah, the president, the government, people like you probably, et cetera, right? So here's the question I want to ask you. What is the feel, or what are the opinions of the people in Iran now as a result of this war? Are they less apt to support their government, more apt to support their government? And what are their feelings toward the United States and Israel now that maybe have changed, good or bad?
Well, you know, Rick, I've never been a government official, and the only people who may hate me in Iran may be perhaps students who didn't get good scores on my exams. Beyond that, I don't know anyone who should be, who's too angry with me. I've never felt uncomfortable anywhere in Tehran or elsewhere in the country.
Well, and I'm not saying, I'm not saying that you are. I'm just saying they watch you on TV, you're speaking for Iran, so they might dislike you as a result. That was all I was suggesting. I'm not trying to say that people in your own country hate you, and I'm sorry if you heard that in my question, Mo.
No, I was joking. But I think it's pretty clear that the situation in Iran is the exact opposite of what the West likes to think.
Really?
And they always say that Iran is corrupt, Iran is collapsing, the regime, as they like to call it, is imploding, and all we have to do is push it, and it will fall apart. Well, today, we see unity in Iran that I have not seen since Saddam Hussein invaded the country. And people, and Rick, this is really a really key point. People, a segment of society which has traditionally been Western oriented, somewhat pro-Western, these people have become completely disillusioned with the West, because everyone saw that this regime carried out an act of aggression. It was not only not condemned, but Western governments supported the aggression. And when they attacked Iran's nuclear program, which could potentially, hypothetically, leak radioactive material and kill many people across the country, they supported it. They didn't, not only were they weren't even silent, they supported the Israeli regime. So people look at the United States and Europe, young people, those who never experienced the Iran-Iraq war or the revolution itself, and they look and say, this is the reality of Washington. This is the reality of London, Tel Aviv, Paris, and Berlin. And I think that the United States has destroyed that, let's say, soft power that they still had, which was already destroyed partially because of the Holocaust in Gaza. But the rest of it, which is still existed among this segment of society, has just been washed away.
Did you feel throughout this that the Iranian government was getting the proper support from the Global South community, countries like Russia and China and India and South Africa, maybe even some of the Gulf states?
I think that the world has changed a lot, and Iran is no longer isolated. Iran has actually become very popular across the Global South. And back in the day when the United States was the hyperpower, it could effectively sanction Iran and hurt Iran. And also because of the sheer power of Western media and how it influenced the rest of the world, many people thought, believed Western narratives. Iran today is viewed as the good guy. And the West is viewed as, the elites in the West are viewed in a very negative light. And governments are cooperating with Iran in ways that we haven't seen before. And that's why U.S. sanctions are going to become increasingly less effective, and Iran is increasingly becoming indifferent to the behavior of the United States in Europe.
Let me throw a little bit of humor into this conversation with something that happened just today. This is Germany's Chancellor Merz, and he's trying to give a speech where he talks about how evil Iran is and its regime, expected stuff, as you might have, you know, understand from one of these countries in Europe that's a part of NATO, et cetera, all colonial thinking. But look what he actually says. Let's listen to it together.
Not only Israel, but also Europe and the world as a whole are threatened by this Israeli, by this Iranian nuclear program.
He said Israeli nuclear program accidentally, I guess. I don't know. It happens to me sometimes. I got to use these glasses to see things, and I'm not able to see it or something. But, you know, sometimes you say the quiet thing, you know, the truth out loud accidentally. And there is a big question, and the world is asking, and this is a fair question. Why is everybody asking about the nuclear program that Iran has and not asking about the secret nuclear program that Israel has? And I know he didn't mean to ask that question, but it's going to make everybody think that, right?
Absolutely. And the Iranian peaceful nuclear program, you put it aside and then you go to the Israeli nuclear weapon program, and then you put alongside that the genocide in Gaza and the genocidal strikes on Lebanon and the war of aggression against Iran, a regime that is constantly slaughtering people across the region. This regime actually has nuclear weapons. It attacks the nuclear, peaceful nuclear programs of other countries, but the West supports it. It not only condones it, it supports it. And this is the root of the problem. And that is why the West is becoming increasingly isolated. And many of these elites in the West are wondering, why is the world choosing Iran or Russia or China or anyone else over the West? Instead of looking at the mirror, they seem to be confused.
You know, there's people on the other side. If I happen to have somebody here today in Tel Aviv and I ask them for their response to you, I have a feeling what they would say is, yeah, but you know what? For the longest time, Iran has been hitting us through proxies. What would you say to that?
I would say that the ethnic cleansing in Palestine and the slaughter in Palestine has been going on before I was born. And before the revolution in Iran. And Hezbollah, this so-called proxy, which is actually an ally, not a proxy, they were created. It was created as a result of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and the occupation of the capital of Lebanon in 1982. It was born out of that occupation, and they were the ones who expelled the Israeli regime from Lebanon. So they are a national liberation organization. And the refugees in Gaza who lived across, especially southern Palestine, and were expelled and put into that open-air prison or concentration camp, they've been suffering for decades, and this existed before the revolution, and it continued afterwards. So the truth is that the problem in this region, Rick, is just like in Southern Africa with Rhodesia and apartheid South Africa. When you have supremacism, you have evil. In Palestine, we have ethno-supremacism. Iran opposes ethno-supremacism. That's it. The solution for Palestine is the same solution that we had in South Africa and Rhodesia, where all people are equal, Jews, Muslims, Christians. One is not Amalek, and the other one is not chosen by God or anyone else.
Well, that doesn't seem to be the thinking in the present government in Israel, that's for sure, not under Netanyahu. Let me show you something else. This is Mark Rutte. He's thanking Mr. Trump. You know, they had the NATO meeting, and Mr. Trump, as we mentioned earlier and showed, assisted that meeting. Here he is with Mark Rutte, and he is the Secretary General, as you know, of NATO. He's not elected, by the way, and they're a very aggressive organization, just for the record. And here he is bragging that they now are going to have more money in their coffers and they're going to have more weapons thanks to Mr. Trump. Interestingly enough, that money comes from the taxes of people who live in Europe who are getting a little bit tired of using their money for all of these wars that the guys in NATO who are not elected are deciding to go fight. Nonetheless, that's what I think. Here's what he said.
For too long, one ally, the United States, carried too much of the burden of that commitment. And that changes today. President Trump, dear Donald, you made this change possible. Your leadership on this has already produced $1 trillion in extra spending from European allies since 2016. And the decisions today will produce trillions more for our common defense to make us stronger and fairer by equalizing spending between America and America's allies.
I just want to recognize your decisive action, you are.
Thank you.
You are a man of strength, but you're also a man of peace. And the fact that you are now also successful in getting this ceasefire done between Israel and Iran, I really want to commend you for that.
Thank you.
And I think this is important for the whole world. Daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
Every once in a while, you have to use a certain word.
He called him daddy. I mean, Mohammed, what do you think? That was weird, wasn't it?
It is. They are despicable and they are racist. And he's, you know, we are childlike, and that is in their eyes. And that basically means, of course, the Israelis are European. I mean, the Ashkenazi Jews are in Israel don't even have, they're not even Semites. But, you know, that aside, this Eurocentric worldview is the problem. That's why the whole world has turned against them. That's why they're despised across the world. And these people, of course, they're happy to see more money being spent on arms, because when they retire, they're going to be CEOs and they're going to be on the boards of different companies that produce those arms. So while ordinary people across Europe and the United States are going to become more impoverished, all of those people sitting at that table, they're going to be a lot more rich, and they're going to have their children and their grandchildren are going to be living in mansions while others are going to suffer the consequences of such foolish spending and the potential wars that could come about as a result.
There, even if Iran were the worst country in the world and really was not good people, not that I believe that, but let us suppose that they really do need to go after Iran because Iran's a really bad country. What the hell does that have to do with the people who live in London or live in Frankfurt or live those people have to be asking ourselves, fine, find a way to solve that problem, but don't take it from me. Why are you taking my money? Why are my wages down 5%? Why is my inflation up 11%? Why do I have so much crime in my city? Why are all these immigrants taking over our towns? This is what people in Europe are asking. And this gentleman, Mr. Root, and others are saying, no, we need more of your money. And it seems the implication by asking for more of their money to please Mr. Trump is, we really don't care about your lives. We need the money to do what we need to do in other countries because we want to change, I don't know, Ukraine, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, name your damn place. That's the problem that I think most of the world is starting to see, that is so troubling about NATO in and of itself. And it's starting to look to me, Professor, like the people of Europe are recognizing that as well. It's what I'm hearing in places like France and in places like the UK and in certain factions in Germany. Do you hear it too?
Yes, I think the world is changing very rapidly. And according to polls that are carried out by the United, in the United States, by institutions in the United States that are very mainstream, the Israeli regime is hugely unpopular across the world now, even in the West, despite mainstream Western media, despite the statements made by regimes across the board in Europe and North America. If these people cared about humanity, they would not be supporting this Holocaust that we're seeing in Gaza. They don't care about human beings. And so obviously they don't care about the people of Europe either. These are people who care about themselves. They care about wealth and power. They've sacrificed the well-being of their own people in the last 3.5 years of conflict with Russia. And they've sacrificed it for the sake of the Americans. And now, under Biden, and now under Trump, we see, though, that initially Trump said one thing about peace with the Russians. That's apparently disappeared now. But they're still doing the same thing. They're sacrificing under Trump. Europe is sacrificing itself and the people of Europe for the sake of the arms manufacturers, the imperialists. And ultimately, this is going to bring Europe down. It's going to bring NATO down. It's going to bring the empire down. It's happening much faster than we thought it would because of the, in the past, we had the never-ending wars. Now we have multiple and simultaneous never-ending wars, which are much more aggressive and dangerous than the last couple of decades.
There's some pushback in Europe, you know, pushback actually from countries who are saying, you're not getting any more of our money. We're tired of this crap. We're just not going to give any more money. Hungary, for example, Orban saying that. Fico is saying that in Slovakia. In the United States, as a matter of fact, let me show you something. This is inside the United States. This is something I haven't seen, at least so public in the United States. This is last night in the U.S. Senate. Several senators stood up and started railing against Israel specifically for hours, and it got nasty. What they said about Netanyahu and the Netanyahu regime, words they used, and worse. Here's a little piece of that.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has locked arms with the most extreme elements of his coalition. People like Finance Minister Smotrich and Minister of National Security Ben-Gvir. People who have made their political careers based on inciting hatred against Palestinians, against Arabs, against Muslims, and in Ben-Gvir's case, also associated with groups that espouse the expulsion of Christians. Together, they have readily embraced the twisted, shameful, illegal, and immoral plan advanced by Donald Trump to push 2 million Palestinians out of Gaza.
This is fascinating to me as I'm American and I watch news in America, and I was fascinated watching this as I have been by watching people on the quote-unquote MAGA movement. Conservatives are all coming out now and saying, enough! We're tired of basically doing whatever the hell it is that Israel wants us to do. We don't want to be led by Israel anymore. You promised us America first, and you're giving us Israel first. This is what Candace Owens is saying. This is what Judge Napolitano is saying. This is what Tucker Carlson is saying. This is what other people on the right is saying. This is what members of Congress and members of the U.S. Senate are saying. I've never heard this expression so vocally stated. Have you? Does it surprise you?
No, I haven't seen it stated in the United States in this way before, and it's unprecedented. Of course, it's very sad that these people allowed it to happen for almost 21 months now. Before raising their voices. And the only reason why they're raising their voices is because people in the United States, ordinary people, are becoming increasingly outraged and they're waking up to what is going on. So I don't believe that the political establishment willingly is shifting. I think that elements within it feel the heat and they feel that they have to change their position. So the real heroes are those young Jews, Christians, Muslims, Hindus in the United States who went on the streets, who've been protesting, who've been activists, and who've been online and waking people up with regards to the ongoing genocide in Gaza. They're the heroes, not these gentlemen.
It's always so fascinating having conversations with you because, you know, you're just as much in many ways an American as you are an Iranian. I mean, you spent so many years there in Virginia at the University of Richmond where you got much of your education. You understand both cultures, and it's fascinating to be able to, for all the years you and I have been having conversations, I really have a feeling when I talk to you, like you're really trying to understand and share the straight skinny of what you think is happening in both countries. And I think this is important. And I think the world should have more conversations like the one that you and I just had. So look, I just want to thank you for sharing your time with us. I really appreciate it. And I think hundreds of people, hundreds of thousands of people, if not hundreds of millions of people all over the world, thank you as well.
Thank you very much. I studied at the University of Tehran, but I went to school in the United States. And it's clear to me that ordinary Americans, when they see the truth, overwhelmingly, they support the truth. And the only problem is that the United States, ironically, is the most propagandized country in the world, but things are changing. And I'm optimistic about the future, even though I think that we're living in dark times and there are dark days ahead. But I think that I think we should be optimistic and we should have faith in the goodness of people across the world.
As long as we have more conversations, truthful conversations, like hopefully people believe you and I just had, I think we'll be able to meet that mission. Thank you once again, Professor. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Have a very good day.
So here's what we're going to do. When we come back, I want to continue the conversation with a former CIA director who's going to try and break down for us why it is that parts of the United States government has gone so astray. What happened? And what did the CIA have to do with that, or continues to have to do with that? These are the questions we're going to ask when we come back. We're going to be joined by Philip Giraldi, founding member, by the way, of, listen to this, Veteran Professionals of Intelligence for Sanity. Sanity. We'll be right back. This is a really important conversation about what's happening right now in the United States. And those of us who cover the news in the United States and have spent our time covering the news, or most of our lives covering the news in the United States, have seen it change over the years. I mean, I myself have experienced the 60s, the 70s, the Vietnam years, Iraq, after what happened after 9/11. And it has had an impact on control in the United States. Very few people know that as well as Philip Giraldi. He is a founding member of the Veteran Professionals of Intelligence for Sanity. God, do I love that title because it makes so much sense. And he's good enough to join us now to talk to us about what's happening in our dear, beloved country. Thank you so much, Mr. Giraldi, for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
You know, I want to start by showing you something, because when I watch this, and I think you know John Kerouac, he was on Tucker recently, and he tried to describe, and this is a good way to start our conversation, I think it sets the stage, for what he describes that happens to presidents when they take office, and how the CIA almost plays a psych game with them to make sure through kooky intel or cooked intel, they basically get that president to buy into their narrative, which may not necessarily be a real narrative. Here it is. Here's Tucker talking to John Kerouac about this, with Obama in particular.
Yeah, this is something that I've puzzled over for a long time. And I've come to the conclusion that the CIA, at the top levels of the CIA, they really love it when a new president is elected and he has no background in intelligence or foreign policy. Usually, Donald Trump is a very unique figure in this, in yes. this scenario. Very unusual. But Barack Obama, 2 years as a senator, 2 years as a senator, no experience in foreign policy, no experience in intelligence. The day after an election, the director of the CIA authorizes a president-elect to begin receiving a PDB, a president's daily brief. And so the day after the election, they go with this 16-page document marked at six levels above top secret. And they say, Mr. President-elect, wait till you see the cool things we're doing all around the world. And they've sucked him in. They made him one of the guys. And every day they're like, wait till you see the update on what we told you yesterday. It's incredible. And then we get the feedback at the CIA. Oh, the president loved this. The president had a follow-up question on that. Oh, the president said, oh my God, when he read this. Well, that's
Obama. Almost sounds like they're psychologically profiling the president.
Oh, I think that's exactly what they do. And don't forget, they have an entire staff of psychiatrists and psychologists that do exactly that.
And so they use the tools that they have employed for decades to subvert foreign governments, to subvert their own government?
Yes.
Cooked intel, BSing the president, creating a narrative different from what the White House or the Congress wants. Is that true?
Well, I think it's partly true. And I think it's important to recognize that the pushing goes in two directions. We have certainly seen presidents within recent years, within our memory, like George W. Bush, who had his own cadre that he brought in with him. And then we had 9/11, which provided the justification for all kinds of pushing. I was still in the agency then, and quite frankly, a lot of working level officers like myself were appalled by what was going on coming out of the White House. So there are two directions here. The agency certainly takes advantage of presidents who are weak in terms of their background to push its own agenda. And of course, its most important agenda is to keep the money flowing and to keep the 20,000 plus people working at CIA fully employed. So that, you know, there's pushing that way, and there's pushing in terms of policies. Obviously, if you create a situation where you're selling that the United States is in danger and there's threats coming from everywhere, this benefits organizations like the CIA, not to mention others like State Department, to a certain extent, has been selling products for a long time now. And the military, the Pentagon, this all comes down to who wants to wind up with the influence and the power. And it's a game that's played by many in Washington. And it's, you know, and it's, to be honest, it's always convenient to say CIA. But the CIA is not the only player in this game.
That's interesting you would say that, because I've gotten the feeling, and the reason I wanted to show you that was, I'm thinking that Mr. Trump has been getting a lot of cooked intel, because he came in with a mindset of what he wanted to do, just like Obama did, by the way. And all of a sudden, a couple of months later, he's singing a different tune. And I'm wondering, what are they telling him? Because I know the truth is closer to something other than that. For example, Israel. In the case of Israel, how much does Israel control the narrative that's going into Mr. Trump's mind on a daily basis, would you estimate?
Well, I would say that Israel has massive influence over Trump. And again, this is the whole power game and how you manipulate things in government. And, you know, there are billions and billions of dollars that are involved in this process, coming from both directions, coming from people who are bribing the system, bribing Congress, bribing the people who work with the White House. I think Trump was pretty much on board with Israel, even in his first administration, because he played a lot of the tunes that Israel wanted to hear in terms of Jerusalem, in terms of assassinating Soleimani, that was the Iranian Revolutionary Guard leader who was on a peace mission in Baghdad, and Trump had him killed. So there are a lot of things that happened that were Israel motivated, and there's no doubt about that. But there are lots of other players in the game too.
But military industrial complex. But none of those things are supposed to matter. I mean, when you are representing a country, you should represent the people of the country. If I was the mayor of whatever, Kansas City, and you're one of my residents, I would care about what you need, not about what some guy who wants to make money off of me needs or some other city needs. It seems like in our country, your country and mine, the United States of America, people who are elected no longer give a crap about the people they're supposed to serve. And just judging from what you just said, they make decisions based on all kinds of extraneous things that have nothing to do with the people.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. And I've written as much in some of my articles that the number one objective of elected officials should be to nurture the country and to benefit the people who live in it. And I don't see much of that going on. I would say the breaking point, obviously, when the government went kind of sour was with 9/11, because 9/11 kind of justified everything.
Yeah.
And it's still being exploited that way. And this nonsense about how that Trump has been coming out with about how Iran is a threat to the United States. Israel coming out with the same line. This is a joke. And just as Iraq, when we invaded Iraq back years ago, that was a joke. Weapons of mass destruction, this was a con job. And this was done by people inside the system who benefited personally, I will stress that word, from what the system was able to give them. And they didn't give a damn about what their constituents back home were suffering from or anything like that. This is where the system has taken over the government. And the system is basically amoral, and it just tries to make benefits that go to the people that make the rules.
So you say Iraq was a lie, Iran is a lie, and I watch you a lot because I've seen you on Judge Napolitano, I've seen you with Tucker. You're out there on the Googles, as we like to say, an awful lot. But I've never heard what you would have to say about this, so I don't know what the answer to your question is going to be. But would you say Ukraine is another lie as well that the American people are being fed?
Sure. This was a conflict that we started, basically. We have been working on this kind of funny. This comes primarily from the military side of the house. And Russia, of course, is a threat of ours, and Ukraine is an ally of ours. Where this nonsense ever came from is not very clear. I was an intelligence officer working on the Russian target overseas for a good part of my time with the government. And I assure you that all I was seeing from Russia was after Yeltsin, Russia was basically trying to set up accommodations with the West, ways of getting along. It was the United States, and it was specifically people like Donald Trump who canceled many of the agreements that had been reached by Ronald Reagan, among others, to control missiles, to control nuclear arms, and to control all these things. And here we have someone like Trump coming in, knowing nothing, who obviously was being fed something by military-industrial complex or by Bannon or any one of a number of people, and he bought into it fully. And he's still buying into it fully. Why hasn't he made that phone call that would stop the fighting between Ukraine and Russia? Why hasn't he told Mr. Netanyahu to stop killing Palestinians? And why, on the contrary, are we still sending money and weapons in both those directions to allow the killing to happen and continue? This is outrageous.
Well,
it's a war crime.
Let me make a suggestion. And you're a CIA case officer, so this has to bother you or spent your life as a CIA case officer. I think I called you a director earlier. I decided to promote you. There you go.
That's right.
But it must bother you, since you spent the greatest part of your life fighting for America, fighting for your country's truth, trying to make sure the right information and the wrong information was discovered about our enemies or our allies. And here I know that people in Congress are receiving a lot of money. Almost every single member of Congress, for example, receives tens of thousands, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars, for example, from Israel. The President of the United States himself, from the Adelsons, has received, by some estimates, over $500 million. Let's suppose it's only half, $250 million. We know he took a check for $100 million, both from Mr. Adelson and Mrs. Adelson, so that's at least 200. So does money buy the decisions in Washington that we make then? And how much, if that's the case, I don't want to put words in your mouth, does that bother you?
Oh, well, yeah, money buys what it buys, which in this case is policy. During Trump's first administration, he got it roughly $100 million from the Adelsons.
Mm-hmm.
And the deal was that he would be moving the recognizing that Jerusalem was the capital of Israel, among other things. And he also recognized that Israel had total control over the allegedly Palestinian areas on the West Bank.
Hmm.
And he gave them his ambassador gave them a green light to do whatever they wanted with the Palestinians. So that was the first term. Now, the second term, we've gotten another $100 million plus from Mrs. Adelson.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the deal was that, that Israel Netanyahu would have a free hand to do whatever he wanted. And basically the agenda had been hardened, where the gentleman you named, Ben-Gvir, example, these are people who want to exterminate the Palestinians. They'd be happy just to get rid of them, drop them off maybe in the Red Sea or something like that. But they are willing to exterminate them to get rid of them.
So,
and we are a partner to this policy.
So you, a guy like you, spends his life, actually puts his life on the line, because I'm sure you were on some assignments that got somewhat hairy and dangerous, as our soldiers do, fighting for what is right for America. And yet someone else comes along with enough money to make America do something different than what that soldier knows is the truth, and they do it. Whether it's, you know, the weapons manufacturers who decide we have to be at war with Ukraine at least for another 5 years so we can get more money and destroy more planes so then we can make more planes, or whatever their philosophy is or whatever their reasoning is, whatever their MO is for doing this. But they're doing it for a reason that's contrary to Americans' interests. Just like people in Israel or representing Israel who feed money to politicians are making decisions that are good for Israel, but they're not necessarily good for the United States. Isn't that crazy?
It's crazy, and it's precisely correct. That's exactly what's happening. Israel pursues policies that basically, because of the U.S. involvement by financing the Israeli government, by giving them weapons, by giving them political cover in the U.N. and other places. And the U.S., which used to be a respected country in our youth, is now despised by most countries in the world. That's a big loss for the United States in terms of its businesses that operate overseas, Americans who travel overseas. There's been a big change from, remember my days in the U.S. Army back in 1968, how Americans were perceived and respected in the world. That ain't the case anymore.
So you think you think the Global South, the BRICS community, is kind of winning this thing, at least from a messaging standpoint?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening. Look at Donald Trump's rhetoric. How does he make arguments about foreign policy, about foreign countries. It invariably begins with a threat.
Mm-hmm.
With telling them how bad it's going to get if they don't completely surrender in 5 minutes. You know, this is his way of approaching a problem of dealing with foreigners. And he's been talked into this by the people he's wound up as his staff, all of whom are ardent Zionists. This woman the other day, the spokesman who said the United States is the greatest country in the world after Israel. This is a U.S. government official, a spokesman for the U.S. government, and that's what she said. And she's all too common. I mean, look at what some of the stuff coming out of our ambassador in Israel about how God has ordained that, apparently he's ordained that all of these Palestinians should be killed, and Syrians and Lebanese, and all around to the Jordanians and the Iranians sooner or later.
I know it pains you because I know the kind of man that you are, and I know what you've done for a living, and there's more and more people like you, former soldiers, former CIA, members of the Republican Party, people who are in the even, quote, MAGA movement, who are asking these questions now. How did we let our country get in this, to this extreme where forces outside of the United States are the ones making decisions for what's good for the United States, even though it's not good for the United States? More often than not, it's good for certain people or certain countries or certain interests. Philip Giraldi, founding member of Veteran Professionals for Intelligence for Sanity. I love the title. Thank you, sir, for everything you do, and thank you for your wisdom that you've shared with us.
Thank you for having me on.
I appreciate it. Well, and that's it for us. This is the Sanchez effect, as we like to call it, where news is real, it's raw, it's honest, and obviously devoid of any corporate spin. You can catch my podcast, by the way. It's on the Googles, as we like to say. You can find it on YouTube, Journalistically Speaking. And if you want to have a conversation, you can find me on X or Twitter at Rick Sanchez TV. Thanks so much for being with us. I'll be looking for you again. Until next time.